Welcome, I'm Darren Kaster. You are listening to The Green Majority. I am your environmental concierge today. Kevin Farmer is also in the studio today, looking freshly shaven, Kevin. Nice to see you this morning.
Yeah, it's a new look.
If I'm the concierge, I don't know, we'll make up a title for you. Maybe the environmental bellboy?
I can live with that.
All right, we'll both be concierges. We don't want to play favorites here. So, today's show, we've got some fun. We're going to be doing some updates about the special project. We'll be talking a little bit more about the special project to folks that haven't heard of it. Kevin, today, I didn't even warn you about this, but one of the things I wanted to do, because we have sort of a little bit more, I gave us a little bit of free time today. I gave us a little bit of time to have a little bit of play around. One of the things that's been sort of eating at me recently is that we always have so much more to talk about than there can possibly be fit into an hour. I don't like cutting down to just one feature, because then I feel like that's a little bit too much, just sort of us, you know, gabbing at each other and enjoying the sound of our own voices. So it's always a bit of a delicate balancing act here, trying to squeeze it in. So I think this is a great reason why we should, in fact, have more airtime. So we'll be getting that. We're not going to be asking CIUT for that. We're going to be doing, this is why we're doing our other side projects. There's just so many things that we can't possibly squeeze into one show. There's so many events, so many updates to my mailbox that I miss, and so many people saying, hey, can you talk about this on your show, or would you be happy to do an interview? At times, we've been booked more than 2 months in advance with features and whatnot. So I think it's really exciting that we are pursuing our video project currently to do sort of the Green Majority TV. We will, of course, always continue to do free public radio and podcasting as well. The TV show will also be free. It's all as educational tools, but it provides us a little bit more legroom. So, but today, from now until June 1st, when we will be doing the shooting of the commercial by which any of our lovely listeners may, if they're in the Toronto area, come and be an extra in and be part of our Indiegogo campaign commercial video. You can be an extra, wave, say hi to mom, anything you like, wear your I Love Trees t-shirt. Time to get it out of the cupboard. Anything you like, that'll be on June 1st. So right up, every show from now until June 1st will be, I'm going to give it just a little bit more leg room for you and I, Kevin. We'll have a little bit more fun so we can talk a little bit about the project that's going on. And also just maybe get an opportunity to get caught up on some of the cool stories that have been crossing my desk and we just honestly haven't had any time for. We're going to be talking to you today a little bit more about updated climate change information. I've got some interesting some articles here I wanted to talk about as well. The meat and potatoes, however, of today's show will be Liz Marshall and Joanne MacArthur, who is the producer and artist photographer behind the Ghosts in Our Machine, which is a look at all the invisible ways in which animals get used as part of the giant dishwasher of society. They're cogs, they're moving pieces in the giant machinery of our sort of existence here, as far as animals being used both for meat consumption and also product consumption in a variety of ways. Animal parts, of course, an example that isn't currently used, but another one would have been before we had our petrochemical animal. Of course, people were hunting whales down for their oil, for lamp oil. Just all the different ways in which we grind up other life in the process of us living our lives, which was very interesting. So we had a good talk with them. We're going to be playing that interview because it's a little bit long. So we're going to be playing it in two parts. It's about a 25-minute interview. We're going to play it in about a 10-minute chunk and a 10-minute chunk a little bit later on to give Kevin and I a bit of time to talk about some of the upcoming news, as I've been mentioning. So, Kevin, if you want to just, well, we won't get into it yet. I'm going to play the first feature, but if you want to just give people an idea of what we're going to be talking about when we get back to you.
Well, I want to have a little more fun with Joe Oliver. He's been in the news again, running his mouth, and I want to dispute some of his, I want to counterbalance some of his rhetoric with, what do you call those things? Facts.
Well, as Stephen Colbert said, facts have a well-known liberal bias.
You know, there's some truth to that, it seems, in today's debate. The other thing I'm tempted to do is reiterate part of what I said last week, because in my opinion, it's the story of the century and absolutely no one is covering it. And it might be the most important news literally of this century. And so far, Mother Jones has picked up on it. Mother Jones, of course, is an excellent publication that has always been ahead of the curve covering environmental news. But they've recently published a bombshell that no one's picking up on. And I talked about it last week. I think it deserves a lot of attention.
Speaking of facts, and one of the other enjoyable aspects of having a little bit more leg room this week, and we're going to take a little bit more of a relaxed, less sort of a hustled and bustled sort of approach, is that I've been able to fact check myself. Now, it's been bothering me, Kevin, because if you'll remember over the past, like, I don't know, 6 months, I keep throwing around, you know, 99% of scientists, 92% of scientists, and just because I knew it was a very high number, but I didn't have an actual number. So today, this just in, folks, I have the actual number of scientists who believe in anthropogenic climate change. This is based on a study of over 12,000 peer-reviewed professional studies. The number is 97% and a decimal place. So henceforth, when we're quoting the amount of scientists, we will go off this. That is a peer-reviewed study, meta-study of 12,000 other studies. They both analyzed the results themselves. So the authors of the study went through and read through all the accounts and gave their own opinion of what the data said. And in addition to that, they also contacted the original authors and asked them for, you know, what was your conclusion based on this? So they both analyzed the information. The person doing the meta study both analyzed each and every one of these studies results to determine whether this indicated or did not indicate anthropogenic climate change. And in addition to that, they asked the actual authors, do you think that this supports or does not support anthropogenic climate change? And the overlap there was 97%.
So yeah, and
we all know that number from now on. And I'll stop making up numbers like 99.9 because that's just not true.
Just to throw that into kind of a glaring spotlight, there was a poll recently in Alberta that showed 10% of Alberta males thought it was okay to hit a woman if she pissed him off. And so, you know, people reacted to that study with horror, you know, but in reality, we only have a 90% certainty that violence against women is bad in Alberta. And we have less social certainty about violence against women in Alberta than we have scientific certainty about anthropogenic climate change. And yet, you know, we would consider in reporting on that study from Alberta, no one bothered to give both sides of the story. No one found someone willing to represent the abuse of 10% and give them a voice. That story was, there was no way people were going to report, quote unquote, both sides of that story. But, you know, it was greeted with shock and outrage, and it brought a response from the premier. But still to this day, you'll get that faux journalistic balance, that, you know, tired game of trotting out some.
Is beating your wife acceptable? Some people say yes, some people say no.
Exactly.
What's up,
yeah,
to you to decide?
But with climate change, it's still okay to trot out a paid skeptic funded by the carbon lobby to naysay the you know, the overwhelming consensus.
I forgot from last week, are you fair and I'm balanced, or I'm fair and you're balanced? I don't remember.
I'm definitely neither.
Lest we become gluttonous on all our free legroom today, Kevin, I want to keep it moving, so we're going to jump right into our first interview. This, again, is Liz Marshall and Joanne MacArthur talking about both the We Animals Project and the documentary film, which is also a book, The Ghost in Our Machine. I would be remiss of my duties if I did not also mention that Joanne has started an Indiegogo campaign, the very same website, Kevin, which we will be using to raise the money for our camera equipment. Joanne is currently using an Indiegogo campaign to sell copies of her book. So if you enjoy this interview, if you enjoy what they have to say and want to see, she does some amazing, amazing photography. You'll have to do, I don't have the link handy. I will be posting a link directly to her Indiegogo campaign at the end of the show with the show post as always. But if you can't even wait, just go ahead and go to Indiegogo.com. It's just exactly like it sounds, Indiegogo.com. You can look up the We Animals Ghosts in Our Machine project. I'm not sure. I believe it's just under Ghosts in Our Machine. But you can go ahead and look at that. So without further ado, this is Joanne MacArthur and Liz Marshall with We Animals. My name is Darren Kaster. Today I will be speaking to Liz Marshall and Joanne MacArthur. They are both collaborating on a variety of projects, mostly which we'll be talking about today is the Ghosts in Our Machine. Welcome, Liz Marshall.
Hello.
And welcome, Joanne MacArthur.
Good afternoon.
So we're going to talk a little bit about the Ghost in the Machine and We Animals Project. Why don't we start with the Ghost in the Machine, Liz, if you want to take it off from there. Just explain a little bit about the photography that people are looking at, the types of shots that you've chosen for your film, and the types of images that you're using.
Sure. The Ghost in Our Machine is a cross-platform documentary, and it's commissioned by the Documentary Channel. And we're very fortunate because it gives us that, you know, national platform to tell this quote-unquote impossible story of animal rights. And so it's not just a film, it's also a website that's very dynamic and will continue to be very dynamic, including an interactive story by the Goggles, who are the former art directors of Adbusters. And The Ghosts in Our Machine features photographer, animal rights photographer, Joanne MacArthur. And in featuring her story, of course, the film prominently features many of Joanne's photographs. And they are opportunities for the audience to reflect on our relationship to animals.
And so a lot of the images have come from a project, Joanne, that you're working on called We Animals, as Liz was just mentioning. Would you like to just give us a little bit of an idea about where you were sort of coming from, what the intent of the project was?
Yeah, sure. We Animals started over a decade ago when I was taking a closer look at our relationships with animals. That came about because I started making friends with some chickens. My mom had some chickens, and I would play with them in the yard the way I would play with a cat or a dog, but then I would go inside at night and have chicken for dinner, and I thought, okay, I have learned that animals that we eat actually have just as much personality as the animals that we call pets. So, okay, there's an issue here, and I'm going to look more at that, and I'm going to change my life habits to reflect my beliefs now. Like, I didn't want to be eating these sentient creatures, and I eventually became vegan, and I started incorporating my work into looking at these animal issues. I started shooting animal issues close to home, they're invisible in our lives. They're everywhere. We wear them. We eat them. They're used in research. We use them for entertainment. So all you need to do is just start looking, and all of a sudden they're everywhere. So there's plenty to photograph, unfortunately. But then from there, I started looking at this animal stuff from a more global perspective. So, bushmeat in Africa, bear bile farming in Asia. Unfortunately, the issues are endless. It keeps me very busy, and that's also why I now have an archive of over 10 years of these animal issues.
So just to put for the listener a little bit of context about sort of what we're talking about here today, animal issues in general, just that whole thing there, you get for people who sort of aren't on the inside of that, who aren't already maybe consider themselves activists or enthusiasts or whatever, it can be a very polarizing issue. It doesn't tend to be a group of people who care about it and people who don't. It there tends to be a very large component of people who either don't care about it or think it's not an issue, having quite a problem with people who do. And you could draw a lot of comparisons. But for the sake of that, first of all, we should say that you are both humans.
We're human animals.
Yeah. Liz, you're into moksha yoga, and you're a denim enthusiast, real person. I probably liked watching cartoons when you were a kid. And Joanne, you told me you like kale and that your dog's name is Samson.
Correct.
So both real people. This obviously isn't everything that you do. I mean, you're both very, very busy professionals. Joanne mostly as a photographer and Liz as a director. But this is more than a project issue for you, is what it seems like from your work. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the social aspect for you and how that your personal relates to your project?
Well, I'm a social issue filmmaker, and I come from a history of making human rights films. And I've traveled all over the world to focus on the plight of the human condition. And then my last film, Water on the Table, focuses on the right to water movement. And when that was done, I realized that it was time to create something new and something different. And animal rights is something I've always been extremely interested in, but had never really delved deeply into it. So the full immersion for me in terms of this particular social issue didn't actually begin until 2010. So what you just said is absolutely true, that there is a almost like a schism or a social dilemma, in that people obviously care about people, and increasingly we care about the environment. But there seems to be, although this is shifting, there seems to be less interest, of course, in our fellow animals. And as Joe was mentioning earlier, there's that cognitive dissonance around how we love our pets and we value wildlife. You know, we care about whales and wolves and things like that, and we love our dogs and cats, but we either don't want to know or we just are genuinely ignorant about the billions of animals that are used daily and annually all over the world as objects and as cogs in the machine. So that is what really sparked that kind of huge concept and reality, kind of, and combined with Joanne's photography and her mission on the ground at the front lines as a war photographer, is what inspired the vision behind the ghosts in our machine.
So, Joanne, I'm gonna sort of redirect that to you, so you'll probably still get a chance to say it. What I wanted to redirect to you on, though, was you came for this. Your photography was the basics for a film, and then that's also its own kind of project as well. For someone who's just looking at your photography, there's a lot of very troubling pictures. You have very emotional shots of very human-seeming emotional faces on these animals, and very gory pictures in some cases of slaughterhouses and this sort of thing. What would you say, though, these are very emotional. The trigger for this photography is that it has an emotional reaction in the person who sees it. Mm-hmm. But I could say to you as well that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily like watching videos of people getting surgery, but that doesn't make it a bad thing. So can you sort of address that idea of, you know, what do you mean by this? Yes, it's horrible, but just because we don't want to look at it, does that necessarily mean that we shouldn't be doing it?
Okay, well, I'm going to tie this into what Liz was speaking about just a second ago as well. I think, you know, go into a room of 100 people and say, how many of you love animals? And everyone will put up their hands, or at least, you know, 95% of them will. And we extend that care to animals that are cute, animals that are our companions, animals that are posted as endangered on World Wildlife ads, polar bears and wolves and whales. And there is a safety in caring about these animals, because there's a distance. Like, we can donate $20 and like help this polar bear over there, and it doesn't really affect us. We can show that we care about animals. We can donate to saving the polar bear, and there's a safety and there's a comfort. But looking at the way we treat domesticated animals, animals in entertainment, this is really, really close to home, and it's personal. It's very personal, and we're all involved. And if we take a good look at that, we're all complicit. And that's difficult. So it's much easier to care about these faraway animals or the companion animals, donate to, you know, Humane Society and help these dogs and stuff like that. But, you know, show people gory pictures of what it's like to die in a slaughterhouse or what it's like to be transported, like the pigs that we photograph at Toronto Pig Save, it becomes very personal, and that's hard to digest. People will put their backs up. They will say, you know, make a mockery of it by saying, yum, bacon, you know, things like that. There are all sorts of defense mechanisms, so it is really a challenge in my work to break through the defense mechanisms and question... I don't know, put the right questions forth so that people don't feel attacked and can think about their lifestyles. It's really hard to get people to think about changing their lifestyles, because that's what my work is doing. It's like, you know, look at this suffering, and how are we complicit, and what do we have to do? We can't just donate $20 to Toronto Pig Save. We actually have to think about pig consumption.
Now, Liz, I saw you nodding your head furiously that entire time. Do you want to throw 2 cents in on that?
Well, just because that is, I think, the huge elephant in the room for, I think that's a good metaphor, for all the time. Because that's what Jo does with her work. That's her life's mission, always. And what the film is trying to do is pose the same moral questions that Jo is doing in her photographic images, in her still images. But the film has brought that to life in a different way, but is dealing with that, the core essence of what Jo was just talking about. So that's why I was nodding my head, because it is a complex issue. It's really hard to grapple with. It's cross-cultural, but it has different sort of connotations within the our highly mechanized societies, within the industrialized, the context of the industrialized system. And that's what the film is actually focused on, is urban, transnational, big corporate, the machine, you know, for lack of a better word.
So just to get very specific on the name, you had a description on the website of what you mean by the ghost in the machine. Do you want to just explain that again?
So first of all, it's the ghost in our machine, and the hour is very deliberate, because it's about the whole project is about trying to inspire personal reflection at the consumer level. It's not about someone over there. It's about us. It's about me. And it's about you, and it's not finger pointing and blaming. It's also not about some corporation, right? We are the corporation. So this project, The Ghosts in Our Machine, is saying that animals are hidden in the shadows of our highly mechanized world. And let's shine a light on them. Let's show the world in a way that the world can want to see. And that's the biggest challenge with this project. You know, I've focused on HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, and there's resistance to that. But of course, that's much more accessible than people actually wanting to say, hey, let's go and see The Ghosts in Our Machine this weekend and get some popcorn and have a great time. So half of the struggle in making this project and selling it to market partners and getting it out there at the mainstream level has been to come up with a concept that is marketable. And that is, when I say marketable, I'm not talking about business. I'm talking about accessibility. I'm talking about exposure. And the last thing I wanted to do was to invest 3 or 4 years of my life into creating a project that will be marginalized and that no one will see.
Oh, sorry. Perfect time for me to be clearing my throat there. That is the first of our two-part interview with Liz Marshall and Joanne MacArthur about the We Animals and a Ghost in Our Machine kind of joint project there. Kevin, before we skip off to our music break, I wanted to get 2 cents. The last thing they were talking about there was sort of individual responsibility as our house vegan. I would like to get your, just quickly to throw your 2 cents on there about sort of how you think about people who are not vegan, because we've been working together now for going on 6 years. You've never once chided me for not being a vegan. So it just quickly, if you want to throw your true sense about your personal responsibility.
I'm not a proselytizer, but I definitely made my mind up a long time ago about how I feel about the treatment of animal welfare, especially in factory farming. And I think the vast majority of people could not who are safely shopping in supermarkets where everything's brightly lit and nicely packaged. I think the vast majority of people couldn't even go behind the doors in the supermarket and see what's hanging there on the racks, let alone visit a slaughterhouse or themselves perform the acts necessary to produce the food that goes on their table. I just don't think they could do it. And I think that says something. I think if you can't, you know, smash a piglet's brains out on the floor in a process that they call thumping, then you probably shouldn't be eating pig. And also, you know, pigs are social, they're intelligent animals, they're at least as smart as dogs. What they say, what your two guests were saying about the bias against certain animals, I think makes eminent sense.
I'll try and find a clip. There's one of my favorite comedians. He's very vulgar, so I if you're an underage audience member, don't Google this, I guess. I mean, cat's out of the bag now. What are you going to do? But Dennis Leary has this great bit about, is like, what are you? I'm an otter. What do you do? I do cute little seal things with my hands. He's like, you're free to go. What are you? I'm a cow. Get on the truck. He's like, no, but I'm a cute animal too. He's like, no, you're a baseball glove. Get on the truck. Anyway, we're going to take a music break now. You are listening to Darren Kaster and Kevin Farmer at The Green Majority. We will be right back. Don't go anywhere in about a minute. Stay tuned.
Don't need a reason to telephone.
All right, we are back. I am Darren Kaster. Apparently today your environmental concierge, joined by Kevin Farmer, also the Associated Environmental Concierge for the Green Majority. You are listening to us live if you're listening in Toronto. If you're not, you're listening to us on one of our beautiful, amazing, and very appreciated syndicates. Kevin, I got an email recently actually from an American radio station asking if they might please be allowed to use the Green Majority, and a quite a lengthy explanation at the bottom of the email. The meat of the email was saying, you know, we're just a poor community station and we don't have anything we can pay you, and I was thrilled and happy to reply to them and saying, you know what, believe it or not, I know that we do amazing programming that could easily be seen on the CBC or any major network. As it happens, it turns out that Green Majority is and will always be a free resource for everybody. So you are more than welcome to take it and use it as you wish, as long as you just make sure that you say that it's the Green Majority. So we will soon have an American partner. We may actually already have other American partners, but this is one of the trouble, is that the people keep playing us, and about half of the station we've picked up since I took over from Jordan, Kevin, about half the stations we've added to our syndicate list were ones that I actually found by just doing the occasional Green Majority search in Google.
Right.
People have this terrible problem with, we love you for playing our shows, but can you please tell us you're playing our show, just because we want to help promote you. So yeah. If there's anyone else listening, Green Majority is and always will be free public resource. That is the entire point, is that we're here to provide information for free to everyone. Just tell people that you're doing it, including us. So without further ado, though, Kevin, I don't want to take any more of your time. You've got the floor for about 10 minutes now. You want to update us a little bit more on your most recent global warming climate change.
Well, first I want to take a poke at Joe Oliver, because I can't resist. He's become my favorite politician for saying up is down and black is white. And he's called out James Hansen, climate scientist, NASA scientist, and climate researcher.
Not just any, the head of the NASA Space Goddard Institute. One of the top scientists there, who originally became interested in climate change because he noticed he was studying other planets and noticed other planets that had basically lost all their atmosphere because of runaway climate change.
Right.
And went, oh, crap, this is what's happening
like
here.
Like Venus, which is an example of a runaway climate change right beside us. So he's chastised James Hansen for not knowing what he's talking about. He's called out Al Gore for not knowing what he's talking about. Now he's currently chastising the EU for plans in the EU to list Canadian oil as being dirtier than other sources of oil. So Joe Oliver is ranting about this now, and he's saying that the tar sands represents 1/1000th of 1% of global emissions. That's incorrect. I didn't have time to get the right number. I'll have it next week, but that's just incorrect. And see, I would say Joe Oliver is lying, but I think in fact his grasp of the facts is just so poor that he's spreading disinformation honestly.
Well, we have to ask where he's getting his information from, which is largely and demonstrably, you don't need to be a conspiracy theorist to know that the people who give him his information as a public official is consultants, and the vast majority of those people are oil industry
executives, lobbyists,
and so I think he can be passed off by simply the only information he has access to is the information that is people coming from people who have an invested interest.
Well, I got a real laugh when he accused the EU classifications as being unscientific, since he's rejected the advice of two prominent since he clearly was rejecting the advice from James Hansen, who's a world-renowned expert on the topic. But what the thing is, okay, even if emissions from the tar sands were 1/1000th of 1%, which they're not, Canada produces 2% of world emissions, and the tar sands is a recognizable portion of that 2%. Like, it's way more than 1/1000th of 1%. Even if that were true, the point is not the emissions from extraction, which is bad enough. We're talking about burning the stuff, Joe. It needs to stay in the ground. The extractive process is dirty enough, but you're talking about, it's the third largest proven reserve of crude oil on Earth after Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. And it's dirty, Joe. It's dirty oil. It has a high cost of extraction. And then you extract it solely for the purpose of burning it, and that is the carbon we are worried about, Joe. We don't want to burn. That's the carbon James Hansen is worried about when he says if we burn the tar sands, it's game over for the planet. And Joe Oliver says, but no, it's only 1/1000th of 1%. How could it be game over for the planet? Because we're going to burn the oil, Joe. That's why it's a significant impact to global warming. Okay, I had to get that out. Because, I mean, honestly, Joe Oliver, our Minister of Natural Resources, John Baird, our Minister for Foreign Affairs, and Peter Kent, the shill for the environment, these people have been living in Washington. Like, they go a couple of times a week down to Washington to lobby for Keystone XL. And
now, I've recently visited a friend in Washington, D.C. Hi, Becca, if you're there. But it's beautiful. So I can understand why they'd want to spend a lot of time there, especially during cherry blossoms. It's a really lovely city.
Oh, and the other quote this week that just about made me gag was the parliamentary secretary for the environment minister. I might have her title wrong, but she was going on about, look, the whole world is on an oil-based economy. What we should be doing is pursuing the development of this resource responsibly. Well, you can't responsibly develop more carbon. You just can't responsibly do it. We're at the peak carbon as it is right now, and there's no way to responsibly develop more carbon intensive technology or energy sources. Which brings me to the point I really want to make. Peak carbon. I call it peak carbon. I think I just invented that term. But it's sort
of, but it's been labeled Kevin Farmer invented peak carbon. Copy that.
But we talk about tipping points in climate change, and what a tipping point is basically the point where a positive feedback mechanism kicks in and global warming becomes a self-sustaining prophecy. You know, one such feedback mechanism is just water vapor. Water vapor is itself a greenhouse gas, and as the atmosphere warms, it holds more water vapor, and holding more water vapor causes the atmosphere to warm, which causes it to hold more water vapor, and thus you've got this positive feedback mechanism that accelerates global warming. So I don't have so many details on the effects of atmospheric water vapor, although I've come across articles that suggest that it is a significant concern. The one that's always alarmed me is permafrost. There's estimated which is frozen ground that contains enormous amounts of frozen organic matter. Now, the permafrost is thawing around the world. And as it thaws, the organic matter contained in the frozen ground begins to decompose. If it decomposes in the presence of oxygen, which only the top layer is going to do, carbon dioxide is produced. If it decomposes in the absence of oxygen, methane is produced, which is at least 20 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So, you know, since you can expect there happens to be an estimated 1.7 trillion tons of carbon stored in the permafrost. If you release that all, even under the rosy scenario where that all got released as carbon dioxide, that would triple the existing greenhouse gas inventory of planet Earth. I don't mean it would just triple human contribution. I mean it would triple the total inventory, of which human contribution is actually relatively small. Mm-hmm. It's just that we're upsetting the balance with our contribution. It's not that we're overwhelmed. It's not that it's such an enormous contribution compared to the total inventory. We're just upsetting a balance that's existed for a long time. We're talking about, if that all came out as carbon dioxide, tripling the inventory.
So I just want to jump in here because I took a excuse me again, I've had a bad throat today. I did actually take a climate science course, and there's a very, very useful example that my instructor gave me, which is that when you're thinking about the carbon balance, you should be thinking about one of those sinks like they have in hotels, where right near the top there's a drain, right? So if you plug the drain, eventually it will fill up, and then it won't fall onto the floor because there's a drain.
Right.
But the drain is a certain size. So, and that should reflect basically there's always carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but we have a natural system where it naturally comes into the system and it naturally is leaves the system through a variety of functions. It would take hours to go through. But the fact in is there's water in, water out. And so mm-hmm. as long as you have a certain amount of water coming out of the faucet, as long as it's less than what's in the hole, or as long as it's balanced with what's in the hole, then we maintain a constant water level. But if you increase the faucet and more water comes in, even though there's still carbon, aka water, coming out that emergency leak hole, if there's more coming in than the size of that hole going out, then we go over and we have a chance for a spill. Yeah. And that's just a really useful way to think about sort of carbon in, carbon out.
Yeah, so to say we're tripling the atmospheric inventory is actually would actually be like a significant global warming event.
So instead of just increasing the faucet, you've taken three entire sinks worth of water and dumping it in all at once.
Exactly.
And we're worried about even a drop getting on the floor, and you want to dump three sinks worth of water into one sink.
Exactly. And the reality is that the majority of that carbon is going to get released as methane, which would amplify the existing greenhouse gas effect by, say, a factor of 40. So, I mean, that's clearly intolerable that, you know, but here's the point. Now, a recent analysis from the Yale Climate Forum that was reported in Mother Jones estimates that the point at which the permafrost feedback mechanism will become irreversible is 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is lower than our international target of 2 degrees Celsius of warming. Right now, the planet has warmed 0.8 degrees Celsius since pre-industrial times. If we turned off all of these emissions tomorrow, we would continue to warm by another degree by the end of this century, which means even if we stopped all anthropogenic emissions tomorrow, like right this minute, if we turned them off now, we would still expect to warm to about 1.8 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times by the end of the century, which is past the tipping point for melting permafrost, which could unleash a tsunami of greenhouse gases, like thoroughly, utterly dwarfing our own contribution. Like if we unleash that, if that genie gets out of the bottle, there's no way to put it back in. And once that process starts, turning off all anthropogenic emissions won't have any effect. And so the tipping point may very well be upon us. In fact, we might be on the wrong side of the tipping point just based on the momentum that the planet has to continue to warm for another, say, 100 years. And if nothing terrifies you, this ought to do it. And I've been writing letters to every news media outlet I can get my hands on, and they're ignoring the story. I can't get any traction with anyone. And I'm going to invite all of our listeners to take some time today to find, you know, fire off some emails, like, you know, Google the Mother Jones article, see what you think, and agitate, because if we don't start taking action now, we might very well be the last generation that can.
Absolutely. Well, that's a great and terrible place to stop all at the same time, Kevin, but we do have to stop. I want to make sure that we get to the other half of our interview. So without further ado, we're going to go to, this is part two of our We Animals interview. This is Joanne MacArthur and Liz Marshall, involved with the Ghosts in Our Machine project. Books of this project are being sold. There is also a movie component as well. You can find Joanne is selling copies of the book via Indiegogo. We will put a link up as well. So if you enjoy this at all, you should go and check out her book. I will provide the Indiegogo campaign link on the website after the show as well. So make sure you go and check out greenmajority.ca. That's just greenmajority.ca. Very interesting. Very easy. And interesting. Easy and interesting as well. But without further ado, we'll go to part two of this interview. If you missed the first part, of course, check the website as well for a full copy of the show afterwards. But without further ado, here we go. Part two, Liz Marshall and Joanne MacArthur. Where I was going to go from there was, like, you remember films like, for instance, very, very popular was Food, Inc., for instance.
Yeah, great film.
I saw a number of times.
Excellent.
I know lots of people got huge, huge traction internationally. Yeah. but there's something that's sort of been, I've colloquially kind of termed the Food, Inc. effect, which is that everybody I know saw that film. Everybody I know was thinking about what they were eating for anywhere between 6 weeks and 2 months. And then 85% to 90% of those people went back to doing things exactly the way they were before.
Right.
So as a filmmaker and someone who's put their career into doing social activism, what are the advantages and disadvantages of that medium as far as trying to convince people of a social point?
Well, you have to make it into a campaign. It has to go beyond the screen, which actually I think Food, Inc. has been fairly successful. But a good example of a model of a campaign, a film that's done that, is Forks Over Knives. It's done well at the box office level, and it continues to do well. They sell cookbooks, and they've got a whole online component to what they do. And the Ghosts in Our Machine is cross-platform, which means that we've got a six-year plan. This is not just a movie, and then I'm moving on to the next project. It's like me and my producing partner, Nina Beveridge, and obviously Joanne MacArthur, because it's what she does. She's not about to stop doing We Animals and move on to some other thing. This is Jo's work. It's her life's calling. So, you know, we're in this for the long haul in the sense that, you know, it's always been a dream of mine to be able to know that there's enough resources or to try to find enough resources and support to be able to have a sense of longevity with a project so that you can actually, there's a measurable value to it over the long term. So a film is powerful medium, it's a powerful tool for social change, dialogue, etc. But going beyond that, I think that's why we offer, for example, something called the Ghost Free Journey every other month, which is friendly, welcoming, non-judgmental online blog where and people sign up for it, but you're chosen through a lottery system. And we have these two online incredible wise women coaches from the U.S. that guide a five-day vegan journey called the five-day ghost-free journey. And every single person that's done it has been an omnivore, and every single one of those people are still on a journey. And we call it a journey because becoming vegan is a solution. It's not the only solution, but it's a journey. You don't just suddenly, some people do, suddenly become a vegan. For me personally, I was vegetarian for 20 years. I only became vegan a year and a half ago through full immersion in the issues. And when I was really allowed myself, because it was the project I was focused on, The Ghosts in Our Machine, to really go there and learn the truth, that was the decision that I made.
When people think of activism, they a lot of the time it comes to mind things like PETA and giant public displays of bloody scenes and this sort of thing, sort of shock tactics, you could call it. You could also think of things like Animal Liberation Front and violent action and blowing up animal testing facilities and that sort of thing. How does your work relate to that sort of action? Where do you lie among the spectrum? And then what are also your opinions on that sort of extreme end of animal activism?
Well, the We Animals, the photos from the We Animals project run the gamut. So there's gory stuff in there, but there are a lot of happy stories, positive stories. And in the interest of reaching the broadest possible audience, I have that diversity of tactics and diversity of photography. I'm totally not opposed to the gory stuff, and I'm not even opposed to the gory PETA ads and billboards because they didn't, you didn't like them, but other people will go vegan because of seeing that once. You know, I get emails. I got an email this week from a guy who saw the photo that I took of a baby calf who'd just been removed from her mother. She's in a wheelbarrow. He went vegan when he saw that picture. So, and that's a pretty disturbing picture. So that will move some people, just as some other people will look at the gore and look at the hard stuff and actually just slam the door on that. But they might react to a positive story of rescue and change their, you know, their ideas about animals because of that. Interestingly, there's a author named Tim Patcherat, and he wrote a book called Every 12 Seconds. He was doing his PhD on slaughterhouses, and he spent 6 months in a steer slaughterhouse. During that time, he continued to eat meat, and he, seeing all this death and seeing what the animals go through, didn't move him enough to give up eating meat. But then he went to a sanctuary a few months later, and he met a cow named Callie, and he went vegan. And that's what it took, you know. So, so some people need to go and experience rescued animals, go to farm sanctuary, or see photos of rescued animals, and see those close-up photos of their eyes, and experience their sentience, and that will change them. Whereas some people are really motivated and moved by disturbing images, like images of slaughter. So, with We Animals, We Animals is diverse in that way, and I fully support diversity of tactics, whether you know, it's people handing out pamphlets in a really friendly way, or people with bullhorns outside of a fur store, for example. Whatever it takes, and as long as we're all out there doing what we do best, I think that that's the best way to create change.
Radical activism is what it helps us evolve as a species all through history. So, you know, I don't advocate for, you know, violence against humans or animals or any of that, you know, or the environment. But I think radical activism is absolutely essential. It's a way for us to wake up. It's a way for us to see. And then there's many forms of activism that are more gentle, that have a different approach, a different voice, a different language, as a way of disseminating the same values.
I also noticed from your work, and I'll get your comment on this as well, Liz, that you don't specifically kind of outline an outcome. You're talking about some of the issues. You're providing information in a visual form, but as well as in an information format. As far as these, this is what's going on. This is the stuff you don't see. Mm-hmm. But I didn't notice any. And then therefore, so are you just sort of is the idea that you kind of let people take from it what they want? Are you trying to get every single person to be vegan?
What's
the intent?
No. And some activists don't like that about me, that I'm not outspoken about the go vegan message at the end. And that's because I don't want people to feel discouraged. If they're not going to go vegan after experiencing stuff from We Animals or the Ghost in Our Machine, they may give up eating pigs and they may, you know, change a few of their lifestyle consumer habits. And that's a positive change. And I want to support that. So I mean, sure, I'd love to say go vegan and I want everyone to go vegan, but I don't think that's going to happen. And I want to support people in any step that they're willing to take. And so I just kind of let people draw their own conclusions. And if I don't punctuate the work with go vegan and it's left open, they come to me with questions. And it's amazing in my humane education programs. I go into schools and talk about compassion for animals, show them what I've seen, tell the stories, and let them think about them and let them come to me. And it's amazing what they come to me with. What can I do to help animals? What about this? What about that? And then that creates dialogue. And I think that, you know, opens up a world of opportunity instead of saying, this is what you have to do. You have to go vegan or you're a failure.
And I have to say that's as a filmmaker, I really resonate with Joanne's approach. And even just at the micro level, Joanne's images, many of the images actually inspire the same reaction. So the images are not telling you, they're inviting you to consider the lives of individual animals, her access to the animals, and the angle that it's almost always eye contact and at the eye level, and the compositions that illustrate the environment that the animal, the predicament that the animal is in and is surrounded by, which is human dominated, is actually very powerful. And those images of Joanne's are actually what inspired the approach for the film.
So I have one final question. I'll get both your comments on, which has to do with the late humanitarian Albert Schweitzer was said to have known pick up worms off the warm pavement and put them in cool grass, with sort of the idea of, you know, we can't stop all suffering, but that doesn't mean we should stop any. Where do you draw the line? Do microbes count? Do bacteria count? Do spiders count? Where's the line for you?
That's a huge question. I mean, life is suffering. Life is death. Life is birth. The cycle of life. That's a massive philosophical existential question that could be the focus of the entire interview. I don't have an easy answer for that.
I have an answer.
I think.
I take antibiotics when I have parasites, so I do kill the parasites in my gut. That's where I draw the line. That's not vegan. I'm killing the parasites that are in me after I go to South America. But I don't know. For me, it's sentience. It's, you know, if why should I choose if an animal can live or die? Like, I don't know what the animal's thinking. And likely the animal is there for his or her own reasons and would like to maintain the life he or she has. So it's not my role to end, you know, step on an ant or crush a worm or kill a cow for food. So benefit of the doubt to them is that they would like to hold on to their life, and it's an easy thing for me to do.
So it's not so much, you know, don't kill cows, but crushing spiders is okay, as just as what Albert Schweitzer was saying. It's almost, you just do as little harm as possible where you can, and every bit counts.
Crushing spiders is definitely not okay.
I agree.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Putting them outside
today
is better.
Or just let them crawl around. They kill lots of flies, right?
Yeah.
So I want to thank both of you very much for joining me today. Of course, that was Liz Marshall, director of the film Ghost in Our Machine. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
And, of course, as well, Joanne MacArthur, who is the photographer behind numerous works, but most recently, We Animals. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. So that was, again, our We Animals interview with Joanne MacArthur and Liz Marshall. We don't want to, we've only got a couple minutes here left, so I'm going to go to a very fast music break, and we'll be back to wrap up the show with a very special announcement and also a really cool last-minute sort of tidbit news item. So don't go anywhere. We're not done just yet. We'll be right back. We've got one more quick music break, and we'll wrap up the show. Right. Very, very brief. Both those songs today were from the same artist. So if you liked it a little bit, that was just a little teaser of the song. Links for the artist, whose name is Davids. David or Davids? I'd have to double check that. I believe it's Davids, but it will be linked on the website. Kevin, we've only got about 4 minutes left. I wanted to really quickly get into one last thing, which was there's a really cool app I saw. It sort of blew up there on the internet. It was all over YouTube, which is my sort of main little hobby horse sort of social media site there as well. I've seen some links on Twitter, which is called the Buycott, B-U-Y-C-O-T-T app. And I'm just going to quickly read the description, Kevin, and then we'll get a very brief comment from you as well. The Buycott app is the opposite of a boycott. Buycott helps you organize your everyday consumer spending so that it reflects your principles. Example, during the SOPA-PIPA debate in 2012, a number of companies pushed to pass legislation that reduced online freedom of expression while other companies fought hard to oppose the legislation. With Buycott, a campaign can be quickly created around a cause and with a global targeting with the goal of targeting companies with a boycott unless they change their position or boycotting a company to show your support. So what this app does, Kevin, it goes on your smartphone, you scan the QR code or the barcode, and it will bring up who the parent company is. So that's one of the things we've talked about, for instance, a lot. Where, for instance, if you buy this or that product, you may not realize that it's Monsanto has Monsanto ingredients in it. That's one way to get around it. There's also companies that are heavily, heavily invested in the oil sands or the tar sands. So there's two things I really like about this. One, right off the bat, we totally agreement on here. I already know we are. Fantastic idea.
It's great. So
it's a really, really great idea. Yeah. But the reason why it's a great idea is not just because someone has created a list. And here's reason two, this is a great idea. It's not just that whoever made this app has made a list of things they don't like. And if you get the app, it sort of points those out. The whole reason why this is an amazing idea is that it just helps you track it, but doesn't tell you what to think about it. So you can actually create your own campaigns, and you can share them with your friends. So if Monsanto is a company I really want to avoid, but I'm not terribly concerned about SOPA, although you should, internet freedom is very important, but say you don't care about SOPA, but you do care about Monsanto, well, you can create a one and say, oh, well, I didn't realize Monsanto was so closely related to this other company. And so you add them to your own personal one, and it simply allows you to make informed buying decisions. This is something, when I was taking all my economics classes, there's this thing where the economics assumes perfect information to the customer, something we don't have. Right. Which is why, partially why the economic system is so corrupt. I still think that, we still live in the model of our economics is still very good, but it's been corrupted by all this money, and because it doesn't actually work in reality the way it's supposed to. This app helps you do that. It allows you to remain informed as a consumer. Kevin, you've got 10 seconds, go.
Just please consume less.
Consume less in general, and when you're consuming, avoid Monsanto.
Consume less, but if you've got to consume, this is a great app that'll help you consume responsibly.
All right, well, we've got to go. Unfortunately, we are right up against the end of the show. I don't want to impinge on my lovely next producer's show. That, of course, will be a great music show. We're going to have to leave it there. We've got an entire next week's show is going to be about politics and the art of getting elected. Kevin actually proposed this during the music break there. We've got a great idea, so don't miss us next week. We'll be right back here on CIUT and our lovely syndicates. That's all this week for the Green Majority. I'm Darren Kaster.
I'm Kevin Farmer.
And that's it for the Green Majority.